Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the May 1st, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week looks like the inside of one of these big data centers, maybe an AI data center. Two stacks of computers forming a hall in between them. And all up and down that hallway, we've got some very angry people. We've got a woman with a baseball bat, man in a suit with a sledgehammer, a little further back, another guy with an axe. And they are just pounding the computers. The headline is Rage Against the Machine, Why the AI Backlash is Going Mainstream and Getting Violent. We'll pick that up on the Talking Points page, but as usual, we'll start with one of the main stories. Iran flexes its power over Strait of Hormuz. What happened? With peace talks between the U.S. and Iran at an impasse, the clash for control of the crucial Strait of Hormuz intensified this week as Iran seized at least two cargo ships in the trade corridor in retaliation for a U.S. naval blockade of its ports. The Navy has turned back some 30 ships trying to enter or exit Iranian ports since the blockade was imposed earlier this month. And in a bid to ramp up the economic pressure on Tehran, the U.S. this week boarded a tanker carrying Iranian oil in the Indian Ocean and seized an Iranian-flagged container ship that tried to run the blockade. The Iranian regime accused the U.S. of piracy and soon after seized two cargo ships, one flying a Panamanian flag, the other a Liberian flag, claiming the vessels had tried to navigate the contested strait without its approval. White House spokesperson Caroline Levitt said Iran's attacks on international vessels didn't constitute a violation of the U.S.-Iran ceasefire. The U.S. delegation, led by Vice President J.D. Vance, was set to travel to Pakistan for a second round of peace talks, but the trip was delayed after Iran refused to take part. Foreign Ministry spokesmen cited contradictory messages and inconsistent behavior from the Americans. Other Iranian officials cited the blockade, which the regime called an act of war. Trump, who had warned that the military is raring to go for strikes on Iran if a deal wasn't reached before the temporary ceasefire ended this week, extended the truce indefinitely, saying Iran's leadership was fractured and needed time to come up with a unified proposal. Iranian officials accused Trump of trying to buy time for a surprise strike. With traffic at a standstill in the strait, which carried some 20% of the world's oil before the start of the war, U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright acknowledged that gas prices, now averaging about $4 a gallon, might not drop below $3 until next year. Trump said that's totally wrong and that prices will plummet as soon as this ends, a claim experts call unrealistic. Oil and gasoline rise very quickly, and they come down very slowly, said economist Peter Earle. A new Quinnipiac poll found 65% of Americans blame Trump for the spike in gas prices, and more than half blame him a lot. What the columnist said. As Trump's approval numbers plunge to the mid-30s, associates say he wants out of the increasingly unpopular war, said Barak Ravid in Axios. His negotiators suspect a peace deal is within reach, but that they may not have anyone in Tehran empowered to say yes. Hardline generals from the elite Revolutionary Guard now run the country, and they're openly at odds over strategy with Iran's civilian negotiators. The new supreme leader, Mojtaba Khamenei, could break the impasse, but he is rumored to have been badly wounded in the airstrike that killed his father, former Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, and is barely communicating. There's another major obstacle, said Elena Treen and Kevin Liptak in CNN.com. The Iranians don't trust Trump. The two sides seemed last week to be nearing an agreement. Then Trump went on a tear on social media and in interviews, falsely claiming Iran had agreed to a host of provisions that hadn't been finalized and had accepted the most contentious U.S. demands, such as handing over its stockpile of enriched uranium. That tanked the rising optimism for a deal, and it's unclear where peace talks go from here. Even Trump's most basic claims about the Iran war can't be trusted, said Daniel Dale, also in CNN.com. He said this week that Vance was en route to Islamabad. In fact, the Veep had never left the U.S., and he falsely claimed last week that Iran had agreed to never again close the Strait of Hormuz. Virtually nothing the president says can be taken at face value, a situation the world has never had to contend with. He's confounded not just negotiators, but ordinary Americans, said Peter Hamby and Puck. A new poll shows they have no idea why this war is happening, with answers ranging from keeping Iran from getting nukes, 22%, to taking oil, 20%, to a show of power, 13%. Control of the Strait has become the strategic fulcrum of the war, said National Review in an editorial. Iran seems to think if it keeps the Strait closed, it will exact so much economic pain that Trump will end his blockade or accept a deal that relents on his red lines. He needs to convince Tehran he's perfectly willing to start shooting again and take the Strait back by force. Iran thinks it has the upper hand, said Erica Solomon in the New York Times. After a high-stakes game of chicken, it believes Trump blinked first when he extended the ceasefire with no concessions. That validates its view that Iran's readiness to absorb the economic pain wrought by the war exceeds Trump's. The regime sees this as an existential battle, and no matter how much suffering the blockade inflicts, experts say it's not going to blink. Both sides have powerful incentives to end this. So, in a world of logic, a settlement would be a safe bet, said Mark Champion in Bloomberg. But we're in a realm where logic doesn't seem to apply, stuck with leaders who lack the personal and political courage needed for compromise. In Tehran, fanatical hardliners call the shots. In Washington, we have a president who seems to live in his own movie, reinventing reality to follow a script in which he plays the triumphant hero. It's an inherently unstable situation with no obvious way out, and a return to war looks all too possible. Controversy of the week. Congress, a new era of accountability after Swalwell. An ethics earthquake hit Congress last week, said Zachary Shermel in USA Today, and it's only intensifying. The first tremor was the resignation of Representative Eric Swalwell, the seven-term California Democrat and a leading candidate to be the state's next governor, after he was accused of sexual assault and misconduct by multiple women. The married father of three says the accusations, including that he raped two women, are false and lies. Just hours after Swalwell quit, Representative Tony Gonzalez, Republican from Texas, who admitted an affair with a female aide who later died by suicide, also resigned. In both cases, a bipartisan coalition of female lawmakers had signaled they were moving toward expulsion votes. But this Me Too moment seems part of a broader reckoning. Representative Sheila Chafilis McCormick, Democrat from Florida, resigned this week after the House Ethics Committee found her guilty of spending millions of COVID relief dollars on her 2022 election. And pressure is mounting on Representative Corey Mills, a Republican from Florida, who's being investigated over allegations of domestic violence, revenge porn, and campaign finance violations. He denies any wrongdoing. Why is this happening now? Asked John Vannoci in the Boston Globe. Maybe it's a backlash to the Me Too backlash. Maybe it's our post-Epstein sensitivity to power and perversion. Whatever the reason, it's good for the country that Congress is policing itself and setting standards in a bipartisan way. Swalwell's exit was about politics, not decency, said Alicia Finley in the Wall Street Journal. Democrats knew for years that Swalwell was a sex pest, but they still cheered his relentless attacks on President Trump and nodded along as he declared during Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation hearings that sexual assault victims deserve to be heard. But when the allegations against him became public, Democrats turned on Swalwell in case he threw the California governor's race to a Republican. It's nice that other resignations have followed, said John Alsop in The New Yorker. But the careful scalp-for-scalp arithmetic carries an unseemly whiff of partisan horse trading. Is this a real crackdown on ugly behavior or a choreographed effort to look like they're taking it seriously? The House's culture of turning a blind eye will be hard to shake, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. Yes, the Me Too movement scared some people straight for a while, but it didn't change the essential power dynamic on the Hill, where members drunk on flattery and self-regard routinely abuse the often young, often female staffers who work for them. For the ambitious Swalwell, that culture of sexual tolerance was as much of a draw as fame, power, and the other trappings of office, said Melanie Mason in Politico. A protege of former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Swalwell thought he was untouchable, until he wasn't. Republicans are in no position to moralize, said Christian Schneider in National Review, having handed their party to inveterate horndog Donald Trump. But Swalwell does represent a uniquely Democratic species of predator, the male feminist who trumpets his support for women as a prelude to making advances, then uses his progressivism as a cloak of invisibility when accountability looms. Swalwell, at least, has paid a price, and with criminal probes underway in New York and California, it could get higher, said Ingrid Jock in USA Today. But until both parties stop recruiting creeps and criminals and voters start demanding better, the swamp of congressional ethics will remain a bipartisan problem. Here's a Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for flattery. After Ukraine offered to rename part of its war-torn Donbas region Donnyland in honor of President Donald Trump, in the hope it would win his support for establishing the area as a demilitarized zone that Russia could never annex. It's a good week for EV range after Chinese electric car maker Ceres was granted a patent for an in-vehicle toilet that slides out from under the passenger seat upon voice command. The feature is designed to satisfy users' toilet needs on long journeys, engineers wrote in the filing. It was a good week for pulp religion after Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, delivering a sermon at the Pentagon, prayed for those beset by the tyranny of evil men, vowing to strike down with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to capture and destroy my brother. Seemingly unaware, he was quoting a fake Bible verse from the movie Pulp Fiction. But it was a bad week for conflict resolution. After President Trump told CNBC that, quote, I would have won Vietnam very quickly if he'd had the chance, the draft-eligible Trump was unfortunately unable to serve in the 20-year war due to 4 educational deferments and a medical deferment for bone spurs. It's a bad week for tactical approaches after a drone recording video footage of an armed standoff in Jurupa Valley, California, caught a SWAT officer swiping through his matches on a dating app. This is not representative of my department, said Riverside County Sheriff Chad Bianco, who is running for governor. It was a slap in the face to them. Finally, it was a bad week for science. after Dr. Mehmet Oz, head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, revealed on Donald Trump's Junior's podcast that your dad argues that diet soda is good for him because it kills grass, if poured on grass, so therefore it must kill cancer cells inside the body. This week's briefing is titled, A Rising Threat from Ticks. Alpha-gal syndrome, which can trigger a potentially fatal meat allergy, is surging across the U.S. Why? What causes alpha-gal syndrome? It often begins with a bite from a Lone Star tick, which has a sugar molecule known as alpha-gal in its saliva. That molecule is found in the tissues of most mammals, but not humans, and normally causes no problems when people consume it in red meat. But when alpha-gal enters the bloodstream via a tick bite, the body produces antibodies to fight the intruder. In about 50% of people with those antibodies, a subsequent exposure to alpha-gal, such as by eating beef, lamb, pork, or venison, can spark an overactive immune response that causes hives, joint pain, vomiting, and severe abdominal cramps. It was a terrifying experience, said Roanoke, Virginia resident Heather O'Brien, who in 2019 found herself struggling to breathe after eating a pork sausage. I didn't know I had an allergy, but it almost killed me. In extreme cases, alpha-gal syndrome, or AGS, can cause anaphylactic shock and death. The U.S. confirmed its first alpha-gal death in November. 47-year-old New Jersey airline pilot who collapsed in 2024, 4 hours after eating a burger at a barbecue. Thousands of people are now diagnosed with AGS each year, a remarkable number considering the syndrome was formally identified only in 2007. Alpha-gal has gone from a medical curiosity to a major public health issue in just a decade, said Vinay Jahagirdar, a gastroenterologist at Virginia Commonwealth University. How many people have AGS? More than 110,000 suspected cases were identified from 2010 to 2022, according to the Centers for Disease Control, which estimates that up to 450,000 people may be affected. Some doctors believe it's an undercount. A study co-authored by Jahagirdar found a 100-fold increase in positive tests for alpha-gal antibodies between 2013 and 2024. Once clustered in the southeast, the traditional habitat of the Lone Star tick, the disease is now common across the northeast and Midwest, and is surging along with other tick-borne conditions such as Lyme disease. Scientists say the warming climate has allowed Lone Star ticks to move north to areas where it was previously too cold for the species to thrive. The parasites have also been aided by the booming population of white-tailed deer, their primary host. Lone Star ticks are especially aggressive and move three times as fast as the black-legged tick. They will hunt you, said Sharon Pitcairn Forsyth, a conservationist and founder of the Alpha-gal Alliance. They are like a cross between a lintel and a velociraptor. What are the signs of infection? There aren't any, so most people don't know they have AGS until they suffer an allergic reaction. By getting a diagnosis can be a long journey, both because many doctors aren't familiar with alpha-gal, and because symptoms can take up to 6 hours to appear after an exposure. Andrew Keenan, 58, a telecoms repairman in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, woke up with severe stomach cramps at 2 a.m. after a skirt steak dinner. He then broke out in hives, and his blood pressure fell so low that I sat up in bed and almost fainted. Kenan, who was treated at the hospital for anaphylactic shock, now gets cramps and itching that can last days when he accidentally consumes alpha-gal. But reactions vary widely. Some are allergic to pork but not beef, or vice versa. Some react to dairy, some don't. Reactions are consistently inconsistent, said Patrick Roden Reynolds, a biologist who studies tick-borne diseases. Is there a treatment? No. The only way to manage the disease is to avoid alpha-gal, which is trickier than just ordering halibut instead of lamb chops at a restaurant. Food can easily be cross-contaminated, and aerosolized fat molecules from sizzling meat can cause a reaction, as can many items with mammal-derived ingredients, dairy products, foods with gelatin, medications made with glycerin, personal care products that contain collagen or lanolin, even sugar, which is processed with animal bone char. I'm nervous about everything I eat, said Jamie Ridgway, a Virginia Beach resident who landed in the ER after eating a marshmallow. Some sufferers now avoid restaurants and dinner invites. You don't want to be the social pariah asking people, is this vegan? What about that? Said Massachusetts teacher Kate Sudarsky, 26. How do people cope with AGS? Support groups are growing in hard-hit areas. O'Brien of Roanoke reports an almost constant stream of new members to the online group she's joined. In high-incidence states like Virginia, where up to 1 in 50 residents of some counties has AGS, a growing number of restaurants offer alpha-gal-free dishes. Some eateries have gone completely alpha-gal-free, said Pitcairn Forsyth, who notes a lot of chefs have AGS. Many sufferers carry EpiPens to treat severe reactions. They include Missourian Annie Cottrell Poline, who at home now has separate pots and pans and cutting boards. I have my own barbecue grill. We have two ovens. What are health authorities doing? A growing number of states track cases. 12 now mandate reporting of positive tests, including Kentucky, Virginia, and Massachusetts. Health officials are trying to raise awareness of the condition and to educate people on how to avoid tick bites. Meanwhile, researchers are attempting to solve a number of mysteries, including the reason reactions vary so widely, why the allergy sometimes fades over time, and whether people who carry alpha gel antibodies but show no visible allergic response might suffer unseen health effects, including digestive problems or coronary disease. Treatment breakthroughs may be on the way, but in the meantime, experts expect AGS to keep spreading. It seems like an oddity now, said Brandon Hollingsworth, a University of South Carolina epidemiologist, but we could end up with millions of people with an allergy to meat. And moving along to a few of the best columns. First up, why migrants are treated like animals. The abuses are piling up at Alligator Alcatraz, said Adrian Carrasquillo, and the mistreatment of migrants is intentional. When Florida and the Trump administration opened the Everglades Detention Center last year, its harsh location and cavalier nickname generated both sarcastic laughter and outrage. Most Americans quickly moved on, but Alligator Alcatraz remains a key site for Trump's mass deportation regime. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Democrat from Florida, gained entry and saw 1,500 detainees living in cramped, reeking cages, some configured so that people must use the toilet in front of everyone. When a federal judge last month ruled detainees were entitled to make outgoing legal calls, guards cut off phones and started beating up migrants who complained, causing a broken wrist, shoulder and arm injuries, and a black eye. As punishment, detainees are locked in the box in direct sunlight, exposed to swarms of mosquitoes and extreme heat for hours without water. The camp, said Wasserman Schultz, is a monument to cruelty. The Trump administration wants conditions in its detention camps to be so unbearable that other immigrants self-deport out of fear of winding up like animals in cages. Yes, the cruelty is the point. Thomas Holy War on Progressives. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas is sounding the alarm. Progressives are an existential threat, said Heather Digby Parton. At a speech last week at the University of Texas at Austin, Thomas made it clear he's no umpire making dispassionate decisions about the Constitution and the rule of law. Instead, he spoke as a theocrat who believes that Americans should be governed by natural law with rights given by God, as defined by conservatives like him. His speech was a diatribe against the progressive movement, tracing it back to its origins at the turn of the 20th century, when it arose in response to the monopolies and capitalistic excesses of the Gilded Age. Thomas, however, portrayed the movement as sinister and anti-American. In Thomas's telling, progressivism enabled the growth of government, crushed individual rights, and caused nearly all the ills of the 20th century. In a jaw-dropping statement, Thomas declared it is not possible for America and progressivism to coexist forever. He made it clear that he believes that the country is at war and that his side is aligned with God. That extremist belief is the foundation of every one of his Supreme Court opinions. This column comes from Romania. Could we be Putin's next vassal? Hungary's Viktor Orban did Vladimir Putin's bidding in Europe for years, blocking Russia's sanctions and Ukraine aid. Now that Orban has been voted out, Moscow is keen to fill the void with another Kremlin stooge, said Silvio Sirgu. Slovakia? It has a pro-Russia leader in Robert Fico, but his country is too small and economically dependent on Brussels. Bulgaria? It just elected a pro-Kremlin prime minister, but it's not very influential. That leaves Romania as Putin's best option. Right now, we have a reform-driven prime minister, liberal leader Ilie Bolohan, who has managed to unite our four pro-Europe parties. But the disgruntled Social Democrats are trying to oust him, and they might succeed. What more precious gift could Russia receive than a new government in Bucharest? We're already primed to fall to a Russophile populist party. Our rising inequality fuels the perception that European integration hasn't been so great for the working poor. And our tendency to lap up unfiltered online content makes us easy marks for Russian disinformation. Just look at what happened in the 2024 presidential election, when Russian interference was so blatant that the entire vote had to be annulled and rerun. It's not that Romanians are inherently pro-Russian, far from it, but we have proved ourselves to be the most vulnerable in the region to Putin's manipulation. Time for the last word, our feature article. A Teenager's Treasure Hunt. Michael Haskell, 17, set out to make some money by selling the contents of abandoned storage units, said Alex Vatakul in the New York Times. He ended up learning about life. On an icy afternoon, a 17-year-old named Michael Haskell parked his battered Hyundai outside a cavernous storage facility on Staten Island, New York. Then he fetched a hand truck and wheeled it through a maze of hundreds of identical units, its squeaking wheels echoing through the labyrinth. "Any of these could be a gold mine," he said. He stopped at number 3361 and unlocked the padlock. A musty odor emerged. He looked inside. The unit was crammed with bird cages, cedar chests, old paperbacks, bar stools, and Art Deco lamps. "I think I'll make good money off this locker, which isn't bad since I bought it for $140, Michael said. "Copper is at $6 a pound right now, so I can sell the lamps to the scrapyard. It's all about squeezing every dollar out of the locker." While some teenagers hang out after school playing Fortnite or shooting hoops, Michael has taken up a more enterprising hobby. He buys abandoned storage lockers at bargain prices from public lien auctions with the aim of selling their contents for profit. It began 2 years ago when he watched a rerun of Storage Wars. He has been on an urban treasure hunt ever since. His adventures have brought him to Cube Smart, Extra Space Storage, and Manhattan mini storage facilities in and around New York City. He sells his scavenged goods through his eBay store, Mike's Unique Treasures, to earn over $7,000 a month, a figure backed by the financial records he showed me. He runs his operation out of the suburban New Jersey home where he lives with his mother. The garage is lined with meticulously indexed old magazines, vinyl records, World War II artifacts, rare stamps, VHS tapes, and vintage fishing rods. After finishing his homework, Michael spends his nights at a work table, packaging inventory to ship to his customers around the country. "My friends tell me they're amazed I'm making money at this," he said. "None have asked to come along with me yet, though. I'm not sure why." At the Staten Island facility, Michael took photographs of enticing objects and fed them into an AI image search, Google Lens, to get an idea of their value. Then he used a mechanical saw to break down tattered furniture with no selling potential. "I'm always on search for the next Crispo," he said. "That was my first big score." He was referring to the haul that turned his hobby into a quest, a storage unit he bought in Brooklyn for $450 that had belonged to Andrew Crispo, a shadowy 1980s art dealer. Michael sold a Man Ray painting and some Walt Kuhn drawings he found inside for nearly $50,000. "My family took my hobby seriously after that," he said. It was so simple at the start. When Michael got into the game of flipping used goods, he just wanted to make some money. But the business of dealing in people's abandoned possessions, it turns out, can be fraught. 2 years into his pursuit, he knows all too well that every locker tells a story, many of them bleak. "I'm always trying to figure out the lives behind the units," Michael said as he drove toward another storage facility. "This guy was really into antiques. Maybe he was a flipper like me. But who knows why he abandoned his unit? If you lose a locker, usually you're not financially stable, and your life isn't in a great place. Sometimes it can be a sad story." Michael woke at 7 a.m. the next day and rode the school bus to Bergen County Academies, where he is a senior. He took a math quiz and started writing an essay for English class about the poetry of Lucille Clifton. He tried not to worry too much about what he would hear back from colleges he had applied to, West Lynn, Emory, Hamilton, but he had one thing on his mind above all else: the next hunt, the next locker, the next treasure. On a recent afternoon at home in Bergen County, Michael was scouring auction listings on lockerfox.com to plot his next targets. Not long ago, the room he sat in was filled with Legos. Now it's his office, decorated with his finds: a Hermes 3000 typewriter, framed oil paintings, ancient Chinese vases. "They're King, not Ming," Michael said. "Ming vases are the ones you want. Beside the books and schoolwork on his desk were the tax documents his mother was helping him prepare. This year, he will file income taxes for the second time. He took a long look at the intel generated by a computer program he had developed with ChatGPT. It listed storage units that had been abandoned by people whose names had appeared at some point in the news. One was connected to a politician in Piscataway, New Jersey. Another locker had belonged to a minor celebrity, Brooklyn rapper Bobby Shmurda, whose ascent in hip-hop over a decade ago was cut short by headline-making gang conspiracy charges. After nearly 7 years in prison, Shmurda was released in 2021. Michael paid $90 for his unit. From what I've read, it sounds like he was a one-hit wonder and mostly became famous for going to prison, Michael said. Who knows, maybe there's something valuable connected to his music career in there. Michael's mother, Anna Haskell, was in her study reading the Wall Street Journal. It all started in middle school, Haskell, an investor, said. Michael would go to book fairs where he discovered he could buy books by the bag and resell them. Then he started researching Legos that were going out of production, and he started buying those up, reselling them as they got more valuable. Then he saw Storage Wars. I don't know what he could be one day, but what he's doing is almost like distressed investing, buying distressed assets. Maybe he'll go into the investment path. Haskell considered what her son might be gaining from his locker dives, aside from money. I think he's learning about human paths, about human nature, she said. People's lives are in those lockers. Belongings can tell you a lot about a person. When you meet someone, you might think you know them, but you just don't know. As Michael monitored outgoing deliveries in the garage, he told me about a unit in Hackensack, New Jersey, that had belonged to a socialite. It was heaped with trash bags containing Prada dresses, Hermes scarves, and jewelry. There was also an empty vodka bottles, divorce papers, and distressing financial documents. Her life had clearly fallen apart, he said. You think money solves all your problems? It doesn't. And there was a locker in Manhattan that had belonged to a relative of the first black mayor of Richmond, California. Michael showed me a yellowed local newspaper front page from 1964 that depicted him smiling as he took office. His name was George Carroll, Michael said. I read he was one of the first black mayors of a large American city. Looking at this picture, you can imagine the adversity he faced. He led an inspiring life, which wasn't the case with Crispo. Crispo wasn't just connected to murder. He was involved with so many other horrible things as well. A striver from Philadelphia who reinvented himself in Manhattan, Crispo made his name with his sharp eye for undiscovered painters and his championing of American modernism. After opening his namesake gallery on East 57th Street, he handled works by major figures like Edward Hopper and Georgia O'Keeffe. He became an art world star and tabloid fixture known for his sadomasochistic sex parties that took place in his gallery after hours. One evening in 1985, Crispo and a gallery assistant, Bernard Ligeros, picked up a Norwegian art student named Eigil Dag Vesti and brought him to an estate owned by Ligeros' parents in Rockland County, New York. After a drug-fueled night, Vesti was shot dead while naked and handcuffed. 3 weeks later, hikers discovered his corpse in a smokehouse, a zipped leather hood over the head. As Michael learned in his outline sleuthing, the case became known as the Death Mask Murder. Ligeros was arrested and charged with the killing. Crispo denied involvement and was never charged, though the murder weapon, a .22 caliber rifle, was found hidden in his gallery. Crispo later served prison time for tax evasion and for threatening to kidnap a lawyer's 4-year-old child. He died destitute in 2024 in a Brooklyn nursing facility, causing his storage unit to go delinquent. He had a horrible ending, Michael said. I'm not sure what the lesson is. His life seems like a lesson in how not to live your life. The auction house Bonhams handled the artworks that Michael found in the Crispo locker. With his mother's help, he invested the proceeds from the nearly $50,000 sale into the S&P 500. There may be more windfall yet. Still unsold from the collection is a Yoruban ceremonial staff, which will soon go to auction. Bonhams has set the bidding at $4,500. But around the time Crispo's grim life story left Michael feeling shaky about humanity, he came upon something quite different in a storage unit he had unlocked in Union City, New Jersey. Its contents seemed routine at first. Toolboxes, hammer holsters, saws, drills, some Spanish language comic books. But deep within the clutter, in a tattered box, Michael found a purple heart. After clearing the locker, he went on eBay and found a lively market for purple hearts. One could easily fetch $300, but he didn't list it. "I felt I should return it," Michael said. "I didn't have much to go on because I didn't have an owner's name for this unit, but there was a faded address on one package." The address brought him to a home with a rusted white fence in an immigrant enclave of Union City. A pair of dust-caked Timberland boots sat by the entrance. No one answered Michael's knocks at the door. No one answered his calls after he pulled a phone number through public records. Then he sent a letter. He is still waiting to hear back. He keeps the purple heart in a drawer. Selling it would be disrespectful to a life, to someone who fought for something, even if I don't know who they are, Michael said. I'll never sell it. On an overcast Monday afternoon, Michael endured another math quiz before leaving school to investigate the Bobby Shmurda unit. Walking through the cold toward his car, he ran into Scott Demeter, his junior year history teacher. "What Michael is doing is what education should look like," Demeter said. "So many teens just want to get picked up as an influencer now, but he's doing something that involves entrepreneurial spirit and risk-taking. He's generating real income, too. I just joked with a colleague that we should quit our jobs and do what Michael's doing." After the drive, Michael arrived at a storage facility in Edgewater, New Jersey, and made his way inside. He found Shmurda's unit at the end of a long, dark hall. Its blue metal door rattled as he heaved it open. To his dismay, there was nothing of note inside. A set of weights, plasma TV, pair of loudspeakers. "Maybe the speakers are worth something," he said. "Otherwise, this is junk. His name isn't written on anything, so no one will even believe me that this is Shmurda's stuff." Ever in hope of a jackpot, Michael made his way to a storage post facility in Long Island City. This unit had not been flagged by his ChatGPT-assisted search bot, but he figured it was worth a shot. He unlocked the door and scowled. It was filled with gym clothes, cookbooks, a VCR, and a plant pot. But as he rummaged through the boxes, he grew interested in the life behind all this seemingly worthless stuff. The dusty Ampex tapes, recording masters, and sheets of paper scribbled with lyrics suggested a working musician. Old photos depicted a handsome singer in his 1970s prime, hanging out in the studio with his band. Buried deep in the unit, Michael found a few classic records by a soul musician named Andre Anthony Waters. On the cover of his 1988 album, Heat Up the Night, he wore a leather jacket with a popped collar as he stared coolly into the camera. Michael searched his name on his phone but didn't turn up much, not even a Wikipedia page. "You can see his hopes and dreams in this locker," he said. "It looks like he never really made the big time, though it's clear his music was everything to him. I doubt I'll make much off this unit, but this was a good life story." He started heaving the boxes into the hall. "But you can't get too attached," he said. "It's still got to sell." This article originally appeared in the New York Times. Thank you. We'll read one of the obituaries today. The puppeteer who created surreal TV shows, Sid Croft, 1929 to 2026. Sid Croft made children's television a weirder place. Along with his brother, Marty Croft, who died in 2023, he conjured worlds populated by fantastical creatures that seemed born on an acid trip. Through the two always denied taking drugs. Their first original show, H.R. Puffin Stuff, from 1969, featured a galumphing dragon who protects a boy from the wicked Witchy Poo. Lidsville, 1971, was a world of talking hats. And Sigmund and the Sea Monsters, 1973, starred an underwater creature shunned by his family because he wouldn't scare people. Croft provided most of the wacky ideas and engineered the full-body mascot-style costumes, while his brother persuaded the network executives to go along. "When you're nuts," Croft said in 2006, "you've got to go nuts all the way." The brothers like to say that they came from a long line of puppeteers, said the Hollywood Reporter. In fact, that story was fabricated, but Croft did start puppet work young. Born Sidas Yolas to Greek and Hungarian immigrants in Montreal, he was doing puppetry for the Ringling Brothers Circus by age 15, and by his 20s was opening for Judy Garland. Then his brother joined him, and in 1961 they launched Les Poupées de Paris, a burlesque puppet show featuring mostly topless women that toured America and played at several world's fairs. NBC recruited them to design costumes for one show, and in 1969 greenlit H.R. Puffin Stuff, which lasted only 17 episodes, but found new life in reruns. For Land of the Lost, which ran from 1974 to 1976, the Crofts placed live-action humans alongside stop-motion animated dinosaurs to depict an alternate time-warped universe, and employed a linguist to help create a language for the ape-like Pakuni characters. Yet they did not limit themselves to Saturday morning fare, said the New York Times, scoring a primetime hit with ABC's Donnie and Marie, a variety show starring the squeaky clean Osmond siblings. They also had a few flops, notably 1980's Pink Lady, which featured schlocky stand-up comedian Jeff Altman and two Japanese pop stars who spoke almost no English. In his 90s, Croft resurfaced in the public eye with his own Instagram live show, said the Los Angeles Times. Sundays with Sid featured interviews with performers including Joel Grey, David Copperfield, and Croft's good friend Paul Rubens, a.k.a. Pee Wee Herman. Croft never lost his delight in the work. "I'm just having a good time," he said in 2000. "I can't believe that I get paid for this nonsense that I come up with. It's amazing." Over on the health and science page, we have the language of sperm whales. The sounds sperm whales make are even more related to human language than we realized, a new study shows. The whales communicate through clicks called codas, and previous research from the project CETI had focused on understanding the timing and patterns of those codas. New SETI researchers have found that the clicks also come in different frequencies, similar to human vowel sounds. Sperm whale vowels can rise and fall in pitch and can even come in diphthongs, two pitches in one syllable, as heard in spoken Mandarin. They've identified two, a longer one they called A coda and a shorter I coda. These vary in length and pitch, and they can even change based on the coda that comes before or after, the feature of human language known as a coarticulation. In English, for example, A sounds more nasal in front of an N, as in man. They're not sure, though, whether the tones change the meaning. We're showing that these differences are structurally there, and they're probably controlled, linguist Gaspar Vegas tells National Geographic. We don't know their language fully yet, but we're writing down all the rules. A new class of super magnets. Physicists have identified a bizarre type of magnet that could soon turbocharge quantum and regular computing capabilities. The magnets most of us know are ferromagnets, which can point north in a compass or stick notes on the fridge. In the 1930s, physicists discovered antiferromagnets, in which neighboring atomic spins point in opposite directions and cancel each other out. Both magnet types are used in hard drives. This new third variety, Alter Magnets, combines the best qualities of the first two, reports Scientific American. Like antiferromagnets, Alter Magnets generate no magnetic field. But a subtle geometric twist, atoms carrying opposing signs are rotated 90 degrees relative to one another, breaks a key symmetry and allows them to generate spin-polarized electrical currents, just like ferromagnets. Their existence was first confirmed experimentally in 2024 with cryogenic cooling, and now scientists are identifying substances that can generate them at room temperature. The implications for data storage are significant. Alter magnets spin 1,000 times faster than ferromagnets, so devices using them will be faster. And since they lack a magnetic field, they can pack much more densely into devices. It's like your fantasy magnet, said physicist Peter Wadley, who was involved in the 2024 experiment. It's almost too good to be true. And on the Talking Points page, we have that article referenced with the cover drawing. AI, the backlash turns violent. If chatbots were as all-knowing as we've been led to believe, they should have seen the backlash into artificial intelligence coming, said Martin Bakardax in Barron's. Now it's here. Daniel Moreno Gama, 20, was carrying an anti-AI manifesto when he allegedly threw a Molotov cocktail at OpenAI CEO Sam Altman's $27 million San Francisco mansion earlier this month. 2 days later, a man and a woman in their 20s were arrested for allegedly firing a gun outside of Altman's house. Someone fired 13 bullets into Indianapolis Councilman Ron Gibson's home the previous week, leaving a note reading, "No data centers." Gibson had supported a new AI data center. AI is barging into public life with a pace and aggression unlike any of its technological predecessors. Its creators warn that AI will eliminate half of white-collar jobs in 5 years, concentrate even more money and power at the top, and consume vast amounts of water and electricity. Just 26% of Americans see AI as a positive force. Is it any surprise the backlash has turned violent? On social media, many people justified the attacks against Altman, said Claire Duffy in CNN.com. If the commoditization of what it means to be human is allowed to continue, wrote one Reddit user, violence will be much more common. Some activists deemed Moreno Gama a hero, comparing his alleged attack to Luigi Mangione allegedly murdering UnitedHealthcare's CEO. Before he was charged with attempted murder, Moreno Gama himself posted about Luigi-ing tech CEOs. The Stop AI movement is being driven by young people who've already experienced technology taking over their lives, said Eva Reutenberg in Fortune. But the backlash is spreading across America's heartland as communities reject massive data centers, citing concerns about water usage and utility bills. Americans have stopped or delayed $64 billion worth of data centers in 2 years. Maine is set to become the first state to ban them. In Festus, Missouri, voters just ousted local politicians who approved a data center. These developments signal an escalation in the blowback, said Brian Merchant in his Substack newsletter. AI executives have been warning that they're building a tool so powerful it will automate millions of jobs and might literally end humanity, but seemed shocked we're finally listening. Ordinary people are saying, wake up. We have good reason to hate AI. The backlash will likely only get worse from here. And a couple of the short notes. More than three dozen doctors, nurses, and other medical professionals are running for Congress as Democrats in the midterms. Many were spurred by their anger over the Trump administration's cuts to health programs and its embrace of anti-vaccine theories. There are currently 16 physicians serving in the House and 4 in the Senate. Military personnel are sharing photos of the small meals they're being served on warships in the Middle East, telling relatives food supplies are running low as the war with Iran hits the two-month mark. One Marine on the USS Tripoli shared a photo of a recent lunch, a scoop of meat and a single tortilla. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth denied reports of shortages, saying, "Our sailors deserve and receive the best." On the poll watch, only 38% of Americans think the American dream still exists for everyone who works hard and plays by the rules. Just 17% think their children will be better off than they are. And we've got time for a couple of quotes. Carl Sagan says, "Absence of evidence is not evidence of absence." And Dolly Parton, I like this one. She says, "Get down off your cross, honey. Somebody needs the wood." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.